I enjoy very much this meeting, and I'm very grateful to Vidya for having organized it. I like very much especially this little heretical twist that that was around in the previous talks. So I also wanted to say that I'm very grateful to yesterday's speakers, because they have basically introduced very well what I'm going to talk about. Basically, what Ellen said about stickiness could be the abstract of the first part of my talk, and what Vishwa said about the formation of groups of self-propelling particles, self-propelled particles, is related very much to what I present you in the second part. So I will discuss about the emergence of social groups. This is a work that I'm doing together with Thomas Garcia, who is a PhD student. And the first slides are just like a manifesto to tell you what is the approach I'm taking. I'm not claiming that this is the only, you know, the best approach to study sociality, but this is at least something I understand. So what I mean by sociality is the fact of being in a group plus the fact of acting for the common good. So where the common good means that everybody in the group profits of this common good irrespective of its own strategy. And sociality is supposed to be widespread in microbes other than in higher animals that have been probably traditionally studied much more. For instance, biofilms aggregate even individuals that come from different species, and they are thought of being an efficient way of protection against stresses. Another example that was published recently is flocculation in yeast. So yeast, this is not the lab strain, is a strain of yeast that creates flocs, and this strain is more resistant to chemical stresses of different kind. And finally, the most famous examples are social microbes. So you all know them much better than I do. So Dictyostelium and Myxobacteria. And so I will take a modeling approach that is oriented to study especially the evolution of group size in these microbes. So where you have like a life cycle with an alternation of aggregation phase and a phase of reproduction. So from a theoretical viewpoint, I will assume that basically microbes are units of are individuals in a game theoretical context. That is, they tend to maximize their own fitness, and they reproduce clonally. And moreover, the kind of model we are studying really would like to avoid asking that these individuals are endowed with some cognitive, a complex cognitive properties, as it is, of course, necessary to explain sociality in higher animals. So from this point of view, microbes are a pretty good model system to refer to. And the questions I will ask is how can social groups evolve, and whether group formation influences the evolution of sociality. So the classical view of the evolution of cooperation we can discuss whether cooperation and sociality, to what extent they are synonyms and how they interact. But classically, people studied the evolution of cooperation considering that individuals might be endowed with one of the two different strategies, either cooperators or defectors. And they say that the paradox behind the evolution of sociality is the so-called tragedy of the commons, or free riders paradox.
that occurs because the factors within a group of a given size have always higher fitness than cooperators. And therefore, the social or cooperative groups should be unstable with respect to the evolutionary dynamics. One should not be able to observe them. So the kind of games I will consider. So in this context, people often make use of a certain simplification or formalization. That is, that interaction among individuals is summed up by a certain game. And the kind of game I will consider here is the so-called public good games. So these public good games, they are games that involve N players, contrary to the famous prisoner's dilemma, that is just is a special case of public good games. So in this case, you have, again, two strategies, cooperators that contribute to the public good, but they pay a cost for this contribution, and the factors who do not contribute. And in the linear case, that is the simplest case, the total investment of cooperators is multiplied by a certain factor B, and then it is equally divided among all the players of the game. So the tragedy of the common, again, is that the factor always have a higher payoff than cooperators in the same group.
Could you say what is B?
So B is just a factor, it's a constant. It's the benefit, let's say, people say it's the benefit. So it's how much you increase, for how much you multiply the contribution before it is split. So basically, B and C, they measure relatively the benefit of a collective action and the cost of contribute to a public good.
Growing with the group size, for example?
No, it's here it is fixed. And this is the simplest possible setting, then you can imagine something more complicated. So to put it into equations, we will have that if a group has size n, and B is the contribution of cooperators to the public good, and C the cost of this contribution, then you can compute some payoff that is taken to be the synonym of fitness, of Darwinian fitness. And this payoff will depend, of course, on how many cooperators will be present in this group of size N. So if you have K cooperators, if you have K cooperators, you will have that cooperators will have their share of their contribution, that is just KB over N, and they will pay a cost minus C, whereas the factors are just getting the benefit, so they don't pay the cost. And of course, the tragedy of the commons is that the factors have a higher fitness than cooperators. This can be conveniently rewritten in a different form that I will be using later. So we can rewrite the payoff of cooperators as an effect due to self. So basically the gain, the return that a cooperator has for the fact of cooperating minus the cost, and a term that is due to the other people in the group. So there, in this setting or in modifications of this setting, there has been a lot of models and a lot of discussions about how could cooperation occur even though there are this sort of paradoxical situations. And there are a number of mechanisms that have been proposed to explain how cooperation may evolve. So I just listed part of them, here below I have the citation of a paper that was given by Dominica, and that basically makes also an analysis of these different mechanisms. So this mechanism, from the point of view of what they mean biologically, is so one can see them from their biological viewpoint, or one can just clamp some of them together on the basis of what is their effect onto the evolution of cooperation. So, for instance, kinship, that is, I favor somebody else just because it is related to myself, mathematically speaking, can be considered to be the same thing as limited dispersal. So the formation of groups in a specially extended system creates de facto some relatedness among the individuals in the groups. And then you have some other mechanism that could be optional participation, reciprocal altruism, punishment, green beards. So there is a number of mechanisms that can be seen or not as distinguished from one another. And in this paper, West and the others have basically classified them in terms of whether they provide an indirect or an or a direct fitness advantage. So green beards are some phenotypic trait that allow you to recognize the others that are carrying your same cooperative gene. So, but then, I mean, the definition of green beards is a bit problematic, because originally the idea was that there was really a phenotypic trait like a green beard. But then people have shown that you don't need really this. You need some mechanism that creates assortment in your population. And so the link with the real biological mechanisms is a bit complicated. I mean, one has to decide how wide the definition should be. And I'm not very much for extending too much the definitions to sort of include everything. So I actually prefer, rather than this paper, another approach that consists in considering what is the average interaction environment of a given cooperator in a population. So here, what Flechter and Debeli pointed out is that many of these different mechanisms for the evolution of cooperation, they are simply mechanisms that create an assortment between cooperators, so that if you are a cooperator, you have a higher probability to find a cooperator in your vicinity than if you are a defector. And so basically, the formula they propose is just a generalization of the one I showed you before. So where EC and ED are the expected number of cooperators that a cooperator and respectively a defector will meet. And all this theory, so they are able to basically to distinguish how different mechanisms affect this expected number of cooperators and cooperators and defectors are expecting to meet, and they distinguish basically other different classes. But this is the bottom line: is that you have some assortment mechanism. And all this has been studied in a framework where the group size was held fixed, which is pretty common in this kind of models because it makes things simpler.
Sorry,
yes.
Why EC and ED should be different? This is I don't understand.
They don't need to be different. I mean, if they are not different, then you have the classical tragedy of the common, and the factors will gain over cooperators. But if you have a mechanism that creates an assortment so that on average a cooperator sees more cooperators than does a defector, then this explains why you can have the evolution of cooperation.
This would be something like the green beard you're speaking about,
no? Not only, I mean, all these mechanisms, they give rise to some kind of assortment. So it just depends on which is the mechanism that is at the basis of your creation of assortment. So you can include conditional strategies, I mean, everything. It's pretty general as an approach. So that actually organisms usually don't interact in groups of fixed size, but the size of the group is variable, and actually it is something that might have changed in the course of evolution. For instance, several studies have addressed the group size distribution in, for instance, this is fish, so here to the left. So these are fish schools, and people have shown that you have power law or truncated power law distributions, and they were able to model this on the basis of some individual base models of the kind we saw yesterday. But then, for many other individuals, one can consider that there is a rather atypical group size, so a distribution that looks more or less like this one to the right. Unfortunately, I was not able to find some data about this in microbes. I would really like, I mean, one reads that, I don't know, Dictyostelium aggregates in groups of, 10,000 individuals. But then I would really like to know, maybe somebody of you knows about the existence of real measurement of group size distributions. But let's say that in microbes, usually when you have an aggregate that is formed, you tend to consider that it has a sort of typical group size. And so the point is, what happens if you introduce some kind of distribution in the process of the evolution of cooperation? So some people has done this by just basically fixing the group size distribution, and then they have just simply computed what is the average payoff for cooperators and defectors in such a system. And they showed, he showed Jorge Peña, that when you start distributing the group size, you can have results that are different from the case where you have a fixed group size. And in general, these results, so nothing changes if the public good game is linear, but if you have non-linear public good games, you might have cooperation, whereas in situations where you would expect defection to take over. Another way to change group size is to impose bottlenecks to your system, so you have an external forces that drastically changes your average group size periodically. And in this way, people have shown that through the so-called Simpson's paradox, one can evolve cooperation even in cases where the social dilemma is actually present. And then there are some other works that have considered an evolutionary dynamics of group size. So group size can change in a more or less cyclical way, and therefore you will periodically go to a situation where groups are small. I forgot to say this. Usually when groups are small, the paradox is relaxed. So if you have a system where you periodically reduce the group size, then this allows cooperation to take over. Because in general, in small groups, cooperators have direct benefits. Was there a question?
It was about the previous one, but this one answers it. Thank you.
Okay.
The previous one, I'm not sure I understood. Do you mean that if you analyze different distributions, it means that each time each group is considered as itself? And so, do you mean that for some sizes, the cooperative behavior will win, and for other sizes of groups, the defector will win?
No, on average. So on average, if you have a group size distribution...
Can you repeat the question?
Yes, sorry. So he's asking whether this paper, when you have a fixed group size distribution, whether this means that cooperation wins or not depending on what is the group size in this distribution. And actually, this is also true, but what one considers is just the average payoff of cooperators or defectors over the population. So the problem here is that basically you don't have a mechanism that produces these distributions. You just have them fixed. And then you know that in small groups you will have a higher payoff for cooperators than larger groups, and then it's basically a bookkeeping. It's just, I mean, you make the average and you find out that under certain conditions you can have the evolution of cooperation if you have more than one group size present. It's not very mysterious.
What's the horizontal axis on that? W?
So this W is actually... it's a measure of the non-linearity of the public good game. It's the synergistic effect that cooperators, in this setting, they are considering that if you add a cooperator, then the payoff would not increase linearly just in the number of cooperators or in the fraction of cooperators that are present in the group. So then there are a couple of other models that have considered evolvable group size. So they have considered basically the coevolution of two traits, one of which is the cooperative or defective strategy, and the other one that determines some kind of a preference for group size or a tendency to aggregate. And there is a series of papers from Leticia Aviles and collaborators, they had used this framework to show that actually by letting coevolute group size and cooperation, one would get some groups of finite size. The difficult thing of this kind of papers is that they make quite a lot of assumptions. First of all, they start with an inclusive fitness point of view that is basically already postulating that there exists a sort of optimal group size. And moreover, there is no cost to the fact of forming groups, which could not be the general thing one would expect for biological systems. And in another paper, people have really explicitly given a size preference to their individuals. So individuals would form groups of different size depending on their size preference. But this is a bit tricky to imagine how this could happen in nature, that so individuals are able to select only the individuals who have their own size preference. So, but we will basically start with the same perspective, but we will try to keep the model as simple as possible. So basically, the scheme of the model I will present you is the following. So you start with a population that contains social and asocial individuals. So these traits are genetically coded. So you have that an individual can be either social with a probability x or asocial with a probability 1 minus x. And then you suppose there is some process that aggregates these individuals into groups. And what is important in this process of group formation is that eventually you will have groups that are composed of social and asocial individuals in different proportions. Groups will have in general different sizes, but you will have that the social and asocial individuals have different distributions of group sizes, so different expected group sizes they will find them in at the end of the aggregation process. So here I switched from cooperation to sociality because this trait is not only influenced, the social trait is not only influencing the way groups are formed, that is influencing the expected group size social and asocial individual will meet, but they will also determine their strategy in a social game. So once all these groups are formed, a public good game will be played within each one of these groups, and this will give rise to some, on average, some difference of payoff between social and asocial individuals. And this is basically the fitness relative of the social relative to the asocial individual, and we can update the frequencies in the population according to this payoff difference. So an important thing is that here we reshuffle the population, so there is no relatedness among the individuals that is propagated through generations. So the social trait we suppose that is encoded by a single gene that is costly, so it reduces the individual fitness, and that it in- yes. No, no, there is one for every group. So every group plays its social game. Basically, pardon? Only one per generation, yes. You form the groups, you compute the fitness within every group, and then you average it over all the groups. So basically, it's like if you have, I don't know, the formation of maybe I'm stretching it too far, but anyway, of a fruiting body, then in your fruiting body, dictyostelium, you might have a different composition of social and asocial individuals, and then you have that your fitness is just the average over all the groups you find in the population, and then you reshuffle at every generation. So the point here is that this single trait, it influences both the aggregation phase and the phase where individuals play the public good game. That is, it increases the propensity to form group at a certain cost. And at the same time, it increases the coherence of the group. And we suppose that this coherence is somehow beneficial. So the more coherent the group is, the higher its fitness. So for instance, extracellular fibrils excreted by myxobacteria have been shown to increase the degree of collective gliding, and actually the fact of gliding collectively in order to move out of a given environment towards another one is something that is usually considered as a function of collective gliding and of this slugs or cell aggregates. So this might be an example of a trait that satisfies this hypothesis. So once the payoff difference or the relative fitness is computed, then one can go and look at what is the evolutionary outcome of this process of Darwinian evolution following the scheme I showed you before. So this is, in a very simplified way, it can be described by this equation that is called the replicator equation, where basically the increase in the frequency of socials is proportional to the payoff difference. And what you see in this equation is that you always have no social individual and all socials are fixed points. This equilibria can be either stable or unstable, and classically for the prisoner's dilemma you have this picture. So the social, full sociality is unstable under perturbation, so it is enough to add one defector or one asocial to move your system through evolutionary time to the case where there is no social individual left. But then one might also have cases like this, where basically your payoff difference crosses, so becomes positive for certain values of the frequency of cooperators or of socials. And then you would have a bistability situation where you have the coexistence of, so depending on your initial condition, you would evolve towards full asociality or towards full sociality. So basically, if you take the same equations I showed you before, but this time you will have that the expected number of socials met by a social is dependent. Is dependent on the group size n, small n. And the same for socials, and then you average over the whole population. keeping the same kind of notation where you have a part that is due to self and another that is due to the interaction environment, you will end up with an explicit expression for the payoff difference that tells you basically that you have some cases where a group size distribution is enough for a cooperation to become become established. But actually, these are cases that are rather trivial because you are just saying, on average, a cooperator benefits of its own contribution to the group. So we want to exclude this case. We will call them trivial cases. And I will rather focus on this second term where you have the interplay between the assortment within a group and the difference in group size. So basically, this is a term like it reminds a bit of Wilson's between group or within group variances. So what is important here is that even if you don't have any assortment inside any of the group of your population, you still can have that cooperation evolves due to the fact that group size distribution, differential group size distribution, gives you some variance between the groups you can put inside here. So I will just abandon. This is the last equation, I think, or nearly in my talk. I will just give you an example when this works. So, and this is an instance. Basically, I will present you two models of different degree of complexity that one can interpret in this framework. The first one is a model for group formation by differential attachment. This means that social and asocial individuals are considered to differ just by their the probability of attaching to others, and this irrespective of what is their strategy. So, for instance, one can imagine that they secrete some glue. Secreting this glue is costly to the individual, but then social individuals that secrete more glue, they will have a higher stickiness, simply. And what you do here is that you start with an infinite population. You take a subset, so you create a subset of T individuals, and within this subgroup of individuals, you choose randomly a recruiter, and you let all the others try to attach to this recruiter. So they may or may not attach to this recruiter. If they attach, they are part of the group nucleated by this recruiter. If they don't attach, they just remain alone. And what is important here is that you will have some probabilities of social and asocial individuals to stick to each other. And one assumes that in general, asocial individuals will be less sticky than social individuals. And we made another assumption that is that these parameters of the probability of sticking is in a geometric relationship, and this just translates the fact that the probability, so the fraction of social co-players is the same for social and asocial players. So once you enter a group, you don't want to have assortment or a different behavior, a different expected number of social individuals for the two strategies. That is basically the worst possible case one could imagine. And then if you compute, in this case one can compute explicitly the payoff difference, and what you find is that there is indeed a threshold frequency of socials above which sociality can evolve. And what is more interesting is that if you look at its dependence on the maximal group size that is possible in this system, you don't have a bias towards small group sizes as was typically assumed. So basically, even when the possible maximal group size is very large, then you will have like a finite threshold that elicits the evolution of sociality. This we think is relevant because in microorganism, usually one observes groups that are very large, and while most of the theories for the evolution of cooperation, they are strongly biased towards small groups.
When you use the word evolve here, you're not really referring to evolution, right?
Yes, because it's this is the how the frequency of social would change in time. So if you start here, you will go to one. Let me go to the next slide. So this is so it's a coupled evolution and sort of ecological dynamics. So the ecological dynamics is just the aggregation process that takes place at every generation. So at a fixed generation, you will have that your aggregation process gives rise to certain distributions in group sizes. But then these distributions in group sizes depend on the frequency of socials. So when the frequency of socials changes due to the evolutionary dynamics, also your distributions in the population will change. So you have a coupled dynamics. Yes? This is, I don't know, large.
What about the distribution of variability?
So, well, basically, you see here, in this simple case, these are basically Poissonian distributions, binomial distributions, that basically move with evolution towards groups that have larger and larger size. So this is the group size, and this is the number of groups of that size you find in the population as expected by social and by social individuals. So what you see is that at the beginning you have groups that are relatively small, and you have that almost the same number of social and asocial individuals remain alone. While at the end of the evolutionary process, you have a group size that basically scales as the maximum group size you might theoretically have in the population. And what is important is that you will have many more individuals that are left alone, many more asocial individuals proportionally that remain alone with respect to social individuals. So the variability is basically the variance of this distribution that is not so trivially computed, because you have basically three distributions that are displacing in time.
But the variability in the group itself is going to be
the variability, you mean in the composition of a group? Yes, the question is, what happens if these strategies are adopted when in a situation where there is environmental stress? So I will come back later on the stress part when you have a model that is a bit more explicit, especially because actually these groups is not, I mean, in principle, it is already considered here that since you consider a public good game, you will have that the fitness of the group is higher the more social individuals you have. So if socials are those that, I don't know, are more resistant to stress, then, but I mean, it's, I'm not sure I can put stress directly inside this framework. We can discuss about it later. The important point for this very, very simple model, so it is based just on the fact that individuals can have different attachment probabilities. So it's a completely passive aggregation process. Is that there is no bias towards small group sizes. And also some interesting thing is that the evolutionary issue is independent on the parameters of the game. But what depends on the parameters of the game is the threshold. So this means that in general, you need to have a minimal amount of social individuals to let sociality evolve. And this amount can be large, in which case you would not expect sociality to arise by random mutations, or it can be low. And what is interesting is that you have many cases where you have a low threshold, even though your behavior is altruistic, in the sense that people usually attribute to this so of a strong altruism, that is, you don't have like direct benefits to the fact of being social. And actually, when you consider finite size populations, then basically you have that finite size fluctuations can bring you over the threshold, so it is much more easy for sociality to evolve than when you have the purely deterministic case, that is the limit for infinite population sizes. So this should not be a problem to actually get over the threshold in a natural setting. So just to summarize this first part, I showed you that one does not need to recognize other kins or other individuals that are themselves socials in order for sociality to evolve. But what we, the mechanism we consider here is that it is the attachment probability or the effect that a certain strategy has on the aggregation phase that is what is important. So if you have that different strategies have a different effect on the aggregation phase, then you might have that sociality evolves pretty straightforwardly. So what is important is that it is quantitative differences in the attachment probabilities among the two strategies, and so there's nothing particularly mysterious in that if you think to the biological meaning.
Isn't the reason why you have larger groups just because the cost of stickiness is only borne by one individual in the group?
No, it's not borne by one. All social individuals, yes, sorry. The question is whether the fact of having large groups is not because the cost of sociality is only borne by one individual in the group, but every social individual is bearing the cost. So by the fact of being social, so sociality is something that is like genetically based. So if you are social, you pay the cost. And this independently of what is the situation you find yourself in. But then if there is a group formation process that makes so that you are more often with other socials than when with asocials, then that's enough. So it is what I said before, in this context, it is a gene that has an effect both on the process of group formation and on the issue of, on the fitness of the group.
Do you mean to say that there is such a gene in our genome?
I don't want to talk about humans, but yes, so the question is whether there is such a gene in our genome, so like a stickiness gene. I prefer to restrain to microbes because, of course, the framework is general, but I wouldn't be sure how to apply it to higher organisms.
So there is such a gene in a microbe?
Yeah, that could be a gene that is coding for an adhesion protein. So not a selective, not something that selectively, for which the adhesion of two cells requires that both cells express this.
But is this a heuristic notion, or are you thinking seriously on a gene that has that property?
No, these genes exist. I mean, they have been, they are known in, at least in Myxobacteria. They are known, these genes that code for sort of proteins that are excreted and that confirm stickiness. And actually, sticky strains are usually associated to altruism or to, they are considered to be more social. Sorry.
If I could just make a comment on that point, a great many microbes express cell adhesion molecules. This is not. Some microbes also release factors which induce cells, so these are diffusible factors, which induce cells to adhere.
And by association, they have been linked to sociality.
No, I'm not saying any such thing.
No, well,
all I'm saying is that there is this link between a gene and a protein which has a certain effect.
Well, but it's true that strains...
Like many of them are glycoproteins.
But also, I mean, also for proteins expressed the membrane, it's the same thing. The only thing is that here you don't need it to match the same protein on another cell. You just need it to be a protein that makes you more sticky. And actually the strains that are usually thought to be more social are also those that are usually more sticky. But then you will tell.
I think Paul has a comment. With the mic, please, if someone can do a better mic.
What's the relationship between cell density, numbers of cells, and benefits? What is the cost and benefit trade-off layout here? Is it linearly related, or is there a greater benefit?
So in this setting, the public good games that tell you that the linear one, I have just that the fitness of a group is proportional to the fraction of social players. But then there is no explicit density of the population in the sense that here you have like an infinite population. But I will go back later on this more. Yes, I know it's important, density.
I think.
So, the talk is finished?
No, it's not finished.
No, then I will come back to you, but I would like to redefine some. Restate the original definition of the green gene, the green birth gene. Mm-hmm. And then, my general question is, how do you measure all the parameters that you need for your model? And in particular, I understand that you can make it more mathematically. How can you measure experimentally the frequency of cheaters and of detectors and cooperators, and even more difficult, the benefit and costs of the respective behaviors?
I suggest we come to that in the end.
Yes. Anyway, there will be some partial answer in the next part. This was just the relation we just discussed about this. So now we are trying to implement a more realistic model for group formations that notably takes into account space. And this is something that we do in collaboration with Leonardo Gregore Brunet in Porto Alegre. So the model we have is exactly like the one that was presented yesterday. So you have particles that move around initially in a random direction. Each particle moves with the same velocity, and this velocity is fixed. But then the angle, the orientation of the velocity might change. So one starts with a given population density, and then every individual is only locally interacting with other individuals that are in a certain neighborhood. Okay, these are the equations. It doesn't matter, but just to tell you that when you are changing the orientation of your speed, you take into account a term that is the interaction with the other particles that are around you, and then you have a noise term that basically takes into account the fact that you don't have a perfect knowledge or whatever. I mean, it's the noise term. Everybody puts it there, so. We kept it. So the interaction forces are slightly different with respect to yesterday's talk. So we have that there is again a hard core so that particles cannot overlap one over the other. And then you have a certain radial interval where you have a force that is exerted among the two particles, and this force is repulsive at small radius, and it is attractive at big radius. So you will have an intermediate equilibrium radius that particles would like to get to. And in order to introduce this idea that particles can have different stickiness, what we vary is just the slope of this interaction force, depending on the fact that this individual is social and this other one up here is asocial or with the different combinations. So again, you will have that social individuals, they interact more strongly, so this force will be greater, while our social individuals will have a loser loser forces. And so, and we do the a simulation when we start with social and asocial individuals. This again, I mean, there is a number of parameters that need to be fixed to do this. It's a bit a thought experiment, so it will depend, of course, on the initial population density. But I show you just one example. So you start with individuals that are scattered, and these individuals progressively lump into groups. Some of those groups, such as those ones, for instance, they will eventually fuse. And then, basically, we just stop at a certain point, and we say, okay, the aggregation process is over. Usually, physicists wait until the asymptotic distribution is reached. Here, I mean, the group size distribution is basically the asymptotic distribution. What changes if we let the time go is that there is assortment within, a special assortment within each of the groups. This on longer time scales. But for the moment, I would not consider this. So basically, you end up, this is a process that gives you groups of different size, gives you a group size distribution. You can exactly apply the same way of thinking that I presented you before. So all individuals within a certain group will play a public good game. They will reproduce according to their payoff, and then the whole population will be updated. The frequencies of social and asocial individuals will be updated. Excuse me. So you have, I'm sorry for the colors that change from time to time. So in this case, the green ones are asocial and the red ones are socials. So it's different from before. But this is just to show you that you have, on the one hand, an intra-generation dynamics that brings you to the formation of groups, and then you have a dynamics on the evolutionary time scale, where you have that the groups will change in composition according to the changing frequencies of social and asocial individuals. And what is interesting is that if you look at the group size distribution in this kind of aggregation process, you end up with something like this, where you have a sort of a typical group size of groups and a certain number of individuals that remain alone, they remain outside groups. And this proportion of individuals that remain alone is different if you are social or if you are asocial. Notably, this is because when you are social, you are less sticky, so you tend to switch group, or you are more volatile. So if we do this, if we repeat this, so we look at what happens to the frequency of socials for different values of the parameters. This is the evolution in time. So you see that there is actually an asymptotic value. So evolutionarily, you would tend, in general, to the coexistence of social and asocial individuals in the population. And the relative frequency of social and asocials will depend on the parameters of your system, of course. So for instance, one can look at what happens when the angular noise is changed. Basically, to this limit, you go towards a Brownian motion. And what one can show is that you have basically fixation of sociality with a higher probability for large noise. But if you look at the average payoff of social and asocial individuals, this average payoff will be maximal at some intermediate noise value. And what is, I think, more interesting here, since we have talked about cell movement, is that if cells do not move, so this is the velocity, the speed of the particles. If particles have a very small speed, you can have evolution of sociality, but still this enters in this sort of trivial case where you have direct benefits of cooperators or of socials. Whereas when cells move, so for higher values of the velocity, you have that actually sociality is really is truly a consequence of assortment that is induced by the aggregation process. And this is just because you want groups to be sufficiently volatile for asocial individuals to detach by from a group and go look for another group. In this moment, when they detach, their fitness is minimal in the sense that they lose all the contribution that they could have from the group. And actually, this is a bit related to what is the special arrangement within the groups. Actually, it's not really very very clear to here, but there is a higher number of asocials that are at the exterior part of the group. And this is actually something that has been observed in yeast, where there is this gene that has been called the Greenbeard gene and drives this flocculating phenotype. So when you look at a flock, you will see that in general the flock is composed, if you mix flow 1- and flow 1+ strains, you will have that every flock contains both cells that flocculate and cells that do not flocculate, but at the edge of the flock is not very very visible here, but you have a prevalence of cells that do not flocculate, so the asocial cells in our interpretation. So these are preliminary results that have to be studied further. So the conclusion is that group formation can create assortment and thus favor the evolution of social behavior in very simple settings that do not require mutual recognition or whatever other mechanism that requires maybe cognitive abilities. Group formation processes by themselves can be themselves subjected to evolution. Here I showed you that the average group size and the distribution of group size can change in the course of evolution. And sociality can evolve even though social interactions are costly. So of course we would like to link it more closely to biological mechanisms. And what we are starting to do is also to explore the role of regulation, because of course the first objection to this work is what happens if you have cheaters. And then a cheater in this setting would be somebody who is social in the aggregation phase and asocial in the reproduction phase. But then if you need to switch between two different phenotypes, this might involve a cost. So this is something we are trying to explore. If I have just 5 minutes, I wanted to talk about something completely different. This is just for keeping on with the biodiversity stuff that Bahram was talking about. So these are individuals seen from space, that is planktonic cells, the chlorophyll content of planktonic cells in the global oceans. And what you see is that there is quite some variability in space and time. And so people wonder how are this stuff distributed all over the world. This is a project with Francesco Dovidio and Alicia Soccodato in L'Océan. So what we were able to show is that if you have a planktonic type that is dominant in a certain region, this is often associated with the structure of the horizontal transport that is present in the region. So basically, here you have certain fronts that are generated by horizontal currents, so by turbulence in the ocean, and here you have dominant types that whose distribution correlates very well with the barriers generated by the water flow, which means that basically you could consider a case where during the bloom you have a niche that is defined by the properties of the water in a given region. And since these structures last for about 3 weeks, at the end of the bloom you will have like a more neutral case where populations would interact in an environment that is not optimal for any of them. And based on this, we can think that if you choose one point inside here, it will have a higher biodiversity if it has around it an even distribution of other types. And based on this, one can build some biodiversity maps or a proxy for biodiversity at the global level that allows you to identify some hotspots that are correspond to those that are more or less known, and that is pretty different from the picture one has when just looking at the chlorophyll. And this is just to say that this proxy, it scales with temperature the same way as many other biodiversity proxies. I'm sorry, this was just a parenthesis because we discussed about neutrality in biodiversity. And that's it. Okay, thank you.
Jacques,
you want to begin?
Yes.
Well, first, thank you for this really broad review of the different models that could coin for the appearance and evolution of sociality. Now, about the you mentioned the Greenberg gene one moment, and you finished by showing one example, which was aggregation of the yeast cells, and this article, which was published in Cell, indeed, the title was Greenberg gene identified in yeast. And actually, it's a very beautiful paper because they describe all the molecular mechanisms of adhesion and flocculation. But on the other hand, on top of that, they built the story of the Greenberg gene, and I'm really skeptical about the fact that they fulfill the condition. So, to summarize, the Greenberg gene was model proposed by Richard Dawkins in 86 in his famous book, The Selfish Gene. And the idea is that there are three conditions for having a Greenberg gene. The idea is that this is a gene that will promote the altruism in individuals. And the whole book states that genes are driving our behavior and that the selfishness of the gene can even explain the altruism of the individual. And so the three conditions, I think we should always have them in mind when we read the paper. First condition is Greenberg gene emits some signal. The individual that bears this gene emits a signal. Second thing is that the individuals that bear the gene are also able to recognize other individuals bearing this signal. So the signal, the gene both bears the capability to emit a signal and to sense this signal. The third condition is that the gene must also promote preferential orientation of altruistic behavior towards other individuals bearing the same gene. So this is the three conditions that Richard Dawkins placed in the beginning for this hypothetical model, and at that time it was a hypothetical model. And now over time, during 30 years, now people regularly have invoked these Greenberg genes, but not many people have check that all the conditions are fulfilled. And in this paper itself, this is nothing more than an adhesion molecule. But the altruism, I mean altruism defined in the sociobiological sense, which means a behavior that has a cost fitness for the actor and a benefit for the recipient, is what there is not such a thing in this paper. And they didn't need it. I mean, they made a wonderful paper with molecular genetics, transcriptome analysis, and so on and so on. And then because they build this story on top of that, it becomes a sociobiology paper. But
I agree. I did not want to be too polemical on the green beard stuff, but but actually it depends a bit on which kind of definition of green beard you are taking, in the sense that, so I think that was actually Hamilton, even before Dawkins, that talk about this this kind of mechanism. And actually, in their definition, there was really a phenotype, while then West and Gardner, they started to sort of generalize this green beard concept to the level where any gene that would cause assortment, this might be simply, I don't know, the gene that lets you decide to eat here or there, and then this gene would be called the green beard gene, because then you will have that on the left or on the right, you will have individuals that carry or not this allele. So I don't think that it is of any biological use to extend definitions so much that basically you put inside everything. But it's true that from their point of view, these mechanisms are still green beard, even though I perfectly agree with you. Yeah.
The problem is not the phenotype. Because the phenotype, you have it. The yeast cells, they express the gene, which is a transmembrane protein. So the phenotype, the molecular phenotype is there. The recognition is there as well, because the two cells that bear the FLO1 gene, protein that bear the FLO1 protein, they will stick. So you have the signal and the recognition. What is absent is precisely what they want to explain, which is altering. There is no altering, and their model does not explain. So the problem is not whether you restrict the green beard gene to this or this. The problem is how do you explain altruistic behavior?
Well, what they say is that flocking in itself is an altruistic behavior because it protects from stresses.
What is the cost of the...
General labeling of a local phenomenon with a story on top of it, as you just point out, is very common. Biofilms are a classic example. It may be that if you're in a biofilm, you are more resistant to antibiotics or various other stresses. That would be a consequence, I would imagine, and there's no reason a priori to invoke selection on some benefit conferred on a recipient cell, which to me would be a necessary requirement, at least in part, for the evolution of altruism.
Hello. Initially, you showed distribution of group sites in some fish and other species. And in your final result, you had a bimodal distribution as against something that looked an exponential or a power law. Can you comment on that?
Yes, actually, in the model, like in the Vishak model, you retrieve some sort of power law distributions. So it really depends on which kind of microscopic properties you give, or local properties of adhesion you give. The fact that you have a bimodal distribution, I think it's actually interesting with respect to comparison with real systems. There is actually Daria and Clément, who are now working on visualizing cells that in the aggregation of the Clostridium remain alone. So apparently there is a number of cells that remain outside groups. And actually, if you neglect these cells and you just average over the groups, you will never understand why sociality evolves, because you are throwing away one part of the population. So if you really need to compute the fitness of a population, you have to make your averages over all your possible groups, which also include the fact of being alone. So if you have something that makes you less sticky and you are more often alone, then on average, it might be that actually sociality evolves much more easily. So was it an answer to your question?
I mean, at least at the qualitative level, those two distributions are very different, right? So I can imagine that maybe microbial systems could have this bimodal distribution, and maybe whereas a fish school support box could have a slightly different distribution. And so because of this difference, and it leads to another, my next question relates to another comment you made in the end, which is you think walking interactions are altruistic behaviors. I'm not at all sure I would agree with that, especially with the simplest argument being Hamilton's selfish argument. It's entirely a selfish behavior, not necessarily altruistic behavior. So,
no, definitely. This is absolutely selfish. What I talked about is only individual fitness based.
No, no, I'm not denying that it's fitness based, but the action, as it was defined in the algorithm, does not, it should induce a cost to an actor, and the recipient should have an extra benefit. And that doesn't happen in all walking interactions.
Does it happen in what phase?
Blocking, in generic blocking interactions. For example, in the model I showed yesterday,
no, definitely.
There was no such behavior.
I didn't say it happens in all. I mean, what I'm saying is that in some cases you have situations where group size is regulated. For instance, in Dictyostelium and Myxococcus, one knows that there are things that regulate group size. There are also typical group sizes. So this could be something that is indeed subjected to the evolution, to evolution. But then, if you can explain it on the basis of some local interactions, I mean, I have no problem with that. Absolutely, the contrary. So, and I'm not saying that every time you observe groups, you should expect a cooperation or whatever. Absolutely.
Can I make a comment here, just on a factual matter? It is a common misconception that group size, in terms of numbers, is regulated in Dictyostelium. It is not. In fact, it is very, very flexible. What is regulated, though, which is rather interesting, is territory size. So you can work with cells distributed at a range of densities varying over 2 or 3 decades. Santosh can correct me if I'm wrong. And you get constant territory size. That is interesting. That has still not been fully explained, though one thinks one has a qualitative explanation.
What about the counting factor?
The counting factor is something which tells you, or tells the cells, I guess, that it's ready to begin with the next step of aggregation.
Yes, but that changes the group size. Now, that changes group size if you delete it or...
Okay, I'll just restrict myself to the factual point, because I've done these experiments. In fact, it turned out I repeated experiments which had been done 40 years earlier by John Bonham. Group size is extremely flexible. Not under any kind of regulation at all. Territory size is under very tight regulation.
Can I make a comment on that? It's possible that the group sizes are flexible, but the fusion dynamics can lead to a stationary distribution. So it's not necessarily inconsistent with what she is.
No, 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 no. I just made a factual point. I didn't say there's any inconsistency.
I'm afraid this is going to be a very simple-minded point, but if groups form because of something like stickiness, and there's a benefit of being in the group, I'm not clear why the asocial ones, which don't need to be sticky, how they get caught up in the group. I mean, why is it the case that there's a benefit to those asocial ones if they don't ever form a group? I mean, this seems to be an assumption which actually is wrong.
If they don't form the group, they have no benefit.
Exactly. But why do they go in the group? I mean, if they're not sticky.
They just have a lower probability of sticking. It's not that they are only sticky and non-sticky. It's you can have a difference in probabilities of stickiness, and then the less sticky you are, the most likely it is that you are out of groups, or if you want, the more sticky you are, it is more likely that you are in large groups that are those groups that have a higher fitness. It's just this, I mean...
So, if you're less sticky, I mean, there will be a higher probability that you'll be alone, right?
Yes.
Okay. So, I mean, that must affect the nature of modelling, doesn't it?
The natural modelling?
I mean you had a sort of bimodal distribution. You know?
Yes.
And if you're not sticky...
Yes.
I mean, if that's the phenotypic character that makes groups. I mean, it's not clear to me why they should ever get caught up in a group. I mean, you say that, well, there might be degrees of stickiness.
Because it's about green beards, so it is not your stickiness, it's not something that allows you to pick up the others that are more sticky. It's just that you are more sticky in general, so if you happen to be in contact with somebody who is less sticky, there is still a probability that this one will stick to me, even if it is less sticky. And then altogether you will have groups that are mixed, that will contain sticky and non-sticky individuals. Just the proportion of this sticky and non-sticky individuals might change depending on the group size.
But in your simulations, I mean, they all clumped in the end.
Yes, and they are mixed. These groups contain sticky and non-sticky individuals.
I mean, wouldn't there to be lots of non-sticky ones floating around on their own?
No.
Why is that?
It depends on the speed of so it depends on the parameters of the simulation.
Sure, sure.
If you increase the speed, you will see more non-sticky individuals floating around. This is probably not. I think it is not the same parameter values than this distribution.
I would be so much more happy if what you title this set of simulations and results, something like, you know, if you have sticky individuals and non-sticky individuals, it's very likely that at the end of the game you end up with some sticky groups and some isolated individuals. I mean, it's a segregation of the two types, and the game allows for the sticky guys to win out in clumps.
Yes, in this case, yes, but what I showed you at the beginning is that you can have a general framework where you can distinguish between the effect of the aggregative phase in determining assortment within group or between groups. This is just because I started off with a more general... But then the two applications I showed you where you specify the aggregation process, I perfectly agree with you. I mean, it all boils down to a difference in stickiness.
Yeah. I'm sure you would really like to construct a framework in which this stickiness would somehow emerge out of some other qualities. I mean, that's why it was my question, whether this is really the evolution of stickiness or the dominance of stickiness in the segregated groups.
Okay, so here, since I started with this kind of framework, basically you have like two genotypes. It's like having two strains. The idea is that you have strains that are classified to be more or less socials, and so the idea is that you make chimeras of the two strains. But then, of course, another thing is to see how this stickiness would evolve in the first place. And this, you could imagine that simply you can have that certain individuals mutate and become more sticky. But in a general framework, we are thinking about it with my student to put. So he has done something about putting it in evolutionary dynamics context, so to let evolve also the parameters of the system.
So thank you. I thought that was awesome, and it'll improve my papers no end to be able to cite it. I was just going to make a comment about the kin selection stuff. You're probably aware the latest kind of tactic from the kin selection camp seems to be to insist that in the original formulation, Hamilton never meant relatedness to be anything to do with kinship by descent. And that, in fact, it was always supposed to be a sort of expectation of meeting a partner that's using the same strategy as you, and then they're saying, therefore, these models are examples of kin selection. But, Yeah, I agree with you, it just seems unhelpful, and maybe it's time to just say, well, it doesn't matter what Hamilton meant, that's just not helpful. So. And then I was just going to ask, would you be willing to speculate about any additional advantages to being in a large group other than easier gliding?
Yes, you might introduce other type of groups of games, notably non-linear public good games, in which you would introduce some non-linear effect of group size. You can do that. I mean, it's just. I mean, we decided to take the simplest possible setting, but then of course this will change something. If you have some kind of your fitness increases when the group size increases, then of course it will be probably easier to evolve cooperation or sociality. And if you have some discount effect, maybe it will be a little. I mean, in principle, you could do that. We didn't do it because actually the papers from Aviles, they introduced something that is pretty nonlinear, and then you're not able to distinguish what is the relative role played by the game and by the rest of your hypothesis in determining what is the selected group size. I mean, here we have that a certain group size is eventually selected. And this, even if you don't have, I don't know, some constraints like large groups will collapse or whatever.
Excuse me. With the life cycle model that you had there, which is, I guess, in essence, a trait group model, a prisoner's dilemma in there. One thing that you obviously require to get the groups is some means of assortment, which is glue, no problem. But equally, and I wonder if you would comment on this, you require some means of the groups dispersing at a particular point in the life cycle. And as a mechanistically minded biologist, that's something that's not given for free. And in fact, the capacity to disperse and enter into this global population to reform groups is problematic in terms of needing an evolutionary explanation as the formation of stickiness in the first place, I think.
Yeah, well, the idea was to refer to systems like Myxococcus and Dictyostelium, where you could imagine that if you have a chimera between a social and a social strain, then they will disperse in the same way. So you just compute how many social or asocials you will have in the next generation. But of course, again, this is, let's say, the worst possible case. I mean, of course, if you then have a dispersion mechanism that creates other assortment, then you might have that it is easier to get sociality. This is just, let's say, some not to make the model too complicated, but I agree with you that one could complexify it.
Well, I guess it's more something like Myxococcus or Dicty. They're already highly social organisms, so...
Yes, but how did they become highly social?
Well, that's my question. So the thing that you invoke in the model there, the dispersal, needs an evolutionary explanation as well. So thinking about how it gets going in the first place, to me, makes me wonder. Mm. When I see trait group models, yes, they stick together, and then they need some way of actually disassociating, and that's not a trivial problem when you start to think about it.
Yes, but you may also think that the primary function of forming as slug is to move towards efficiently towards some other place, and so in this case, I mean, you really, even if you did not have the creation of a stalk or of a fruiting body, that could be enough to favor certain strategies over others. I don't know. I'm not.
I guess I'm just wondering, very often I think when the first stage to some sort of clumping would involve probably a constitutive clumping ability, probably not regulated. And the regulation or deregulation of clumping is something that is necessary. It's simply a necessary component of these trait group models. And I think in terms of thinking about evolution, right from the start, this is a problem that's often skipped over, actually.
Yes, you mean that you would not have generations... Yes, no, definitely. I clamped into one single step all that is the developmental path, and I'm not saying that this explains everything about sociality, but just that at least it can explain on a very simple hypothesis how you would get, for instance, an increase in group size without needing much. The question was, is this a free world without a resource limitation? Yes, the resource limitation comes through the public good game. It's not explicitly considered. One could do it especially this special explicit models, but then that would complicate things.
Can you make a link between this phenomenon that you describe of stickiness and the beginning of multicellularity?
Well, maybe. I don't know. I don't want to push it too far. But it's true that you have the emergence of groups. I mean, if by chance you have that a more cohesive group has a higher fitness, this is a simple mechanism to tell you why you could go from single cells to some clumped.
The reason I ask is because, for example, in gonoflagellates, each of the cells that eventually will form, for example, volvox, have a way to move by a flagellum. And eventually, at least being considered as a precursor of multicellularity.
Yes, but then how to go from just a clump of cells to something differentiated? That's something I
you don't want to touch.
I think that actually this kind of models, also the one that was discussed yesterday, they are a sort of could give some inspiration in the sense that, for instance, if you have that cells, red cells or blue cells, they arrange spatially in a certain way, then you might think that this gives a rise to some sort of a structure within the group. And actually, this kind of models, I think they are used, for instance, for the study of cancer. So how cancer cells with respect to healthy cells rearrange themselves within a tissue. So this is just starting from the group that is already formed.
So could you go back to the previous slide, please? The one that you got, that one. Are the asocial individuals red?
No, they are social. I'm sorry. As I told you, it's different colors. So the asocials are green.
The
asocials are green, whereas in the distribution, social are red.
Okay, right. And that solves my problem because I couldn't figure out. If it was red, then you would end up with clumps of asocials.
Yes.
So.
No, I'm sorry.
Very deeply, because you need to break up.
It would be a brief comment, but I think if we think about all this, we should make a strong difference between explaining mutualism and explaining altruism, and the whole difficulty is to explain altruism. And I think that when Paul mentioned biofilms and so on, it is mutualism rather than altruism. So my question is the same as the first one, and I would like maybe we can come with other speeches, we'll have examples and discuss about it, but do we have examples where we can measure the cost of the behavior for the actor, the benefit for the recipient of the behavior, and we can show that there is a real altruism, and we can nevertheless explain, this is really a naive question, but I still don't see a case, and the flocculation, there is no altruism there in this sense, where you can measure a cost, measure a benefit, and show that there is altruism. They scratch themselves to make a few sentences that give you the impression that there might be altruism. But when you think about procreation, it's typically behavior that occurs when there are such environmental conditions that it is in the interest of all the cells to
group together and to fall on the bottom of the contramedium.
Yes, but I mean, I think that their thought is that if non-circulating cells are more sensitive to stresses, and if you have a stressful environment, then circulating cells will have a benefit, and then you start saying that if you mix circulating and non-circulating cells, then the non-circulating ones are cheaters and all this stuff. I mean, I'm not saying I like this this point of view on the thing. I mean, I prefer much more a mechanistic view about the processes that form the flux. This I completely agree, but I mean, it's also the framework where many people have studied this so far. So
I should like to make a brief comment here with respect to the following concept. There are two kinds of traits that you've been talking about here. One, traits of the usual kind associated with the body, let's say with the cell. The second, signals. Now, signals are a rather different sort of entity altogether, because they refer not just to the individual but to other individuals. And we have to be a bit careful in thinking whether a given molecular entity, a protein, let's say, secreted protein, initially evolved as a signal or not. The kind of default, or if you wish, null hypothesis that an evolutionary biologist would make is that the entity initially evolved because in some fashion its evolution aided the reproductive fitness, reproductive fitness of the individual making it. And only secondarily it became a signal. So in some of these models of evolution, one has to be a bit careful, and I think Mr. Greenbeard falls in the same category. It's rather difficult to think of how it arose de novo as a signal. Well, let's end here. Thanks very much. We meet at 10:45, please.